Hi, friends, and welcome to Haydn Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Amelia Mettenbrink, who is a section second violinist of the Minnesota Opera and principal second violin for Sphinx Virtuosi. She also occasionally performs with the Minnesota Orchestra and the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and we'll be talking about her many years of experience as a yoga instructor. Welcome, Amelia. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So it's kind of funny how we met. I met you through Gabrielle Glass, yet again, another friend I've met through her, at her wedding.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's funny for me because I was one of the bridesmaids for that wedding and I was tasked with paying the musicians. So I was really, really trying to. And so I should also say that you were performing for her wedding.
Yes.
Yeah. And so I was really concerned about getting the money. I was supposed to get it from this aunt, but then I couldn't find the aunt. And I was telling Tom, me, her husband, and a bunch of groomsmen about it. I was like, do you know where Aunt, I can't remember her name, is? And they started freaking out too because they're all musicians. So they started pulling out all this like cash from their wallet. They're like, we'll pay the musicians.
Meanwhile, I'm very close with Gabby, and it would not have been a problem if she had mailed me a check later. Yeah. Not a big deal. I trust her. I love her. So,
yeah.
But no, it's so nice the way musicians are like, no, we got to pay him.
Yeah, I know. It was really funny just to see just all the cash come out of wallets. I wish that would happen more often, honestly.
Yes.
But yeah, so, I mean, you played beautifully. It was such a wonderful, beautiful day and ceremony. And so I just have always wanted to reach out again and kind of get to know you a little bit more since then.
Yeah, that was such a cool day because I hadn't seen her in so long for, you know, pandemic reasons and everything. So I just was so happy to be A, playing, B, playing for a friend, C, like outside with other people.
Yeah.
It was a great, great occasion. So
yeah. And also what a miracle that none of us got COVID at that wedding.
I know. She did such good testing and everything, and she picked a good day. It was beautiful out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yay, Tommy and Gabby.
I know. Continued success.
Exactly. So what's your most recent insane performance story?
So yeah, there, of course, we musicians have a ton in our playbook from many years of study and college and all that, but I thought I'd choose one that was most recent to my history. And this past summer, I got a kind of a late call from SP CCO, St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and they were asked at the last minute to fill in for the St. Martins in the Fields, who was supposed to play at the Vail Summer Festival, and they couldn't because of COVID. Something was wonky, I think something with visas, and so they had asked St. Paul Chamber Orchestra to step in. A few of St. Paul Chamber Orchestra members had already gone away for the summer to other projects, and so I'm one of the regular calls for SPCO, and they know I live in town and nearby, so they were like, hey, you want to go to Vail this weekend?
Yeah.
And I said, sure. So we got there, we were playing both the Four Seasons by Vivaldi and Four Seasons by Piazzolla on one concert, along with another concert that was a Mozart piano concerto and some other works with a pianist there. And when we were introduced on stage with the management of the festival, the woman, the pianist who was playing with us, told us in her many years of playing at Vail, because it's an outdoor venue, all kinds of crazy things can happen, you know, like they have squirrels who have run across the stage and, you know, occasionally, you know, wind will blow something down and, you know, we're giggling about it. And yeah, we've done things like Aspen before. And so, sure, those things happen. And we played the first night of performances, Mozart, everything went fantastic. It was lovely. And then we had a day off where we rehearsed for the Piazzolla and Vivaldi. And then that following evening, we were supposed to play the Vivaldi. Josh walks out on stage. We were playing with Josh Bell. We walk out on stage, we start playing, and through the second movement, I believe, of the Piazzolla, we were doing them back to back. So spring, summer.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So you get one of, and then the other, and then the other, and then the other, which was really cool. But we're halfway through summer, I believe. I could go get the video. But all of a sudden, there's like giggling all around the audience, and it's like growing laughter, and then there's like a screech, and he goes, oh! And then Josh, while he's playing, is like moving, and he moves, so that's normal, but he was actually like rotating, like he was stepping around something.
Okay.
And I couldn't tell from where I was sitting what was going on, but in one of the rests, the woman sitting in front of me, Daria, was like, there's a squirrel.
Oh my
and
god!
It's running through the orchestra, and it's like, and it at one point had almost like run up Josh's leg, which is why he had like moved. And
oh wow! Yeah,
and the whole audience is giggling, and people are taking video, and it's that's hilarious. And no, we don't stop playing. We make it all the way through the end of the Four Seasons with a squirrel on stage with us for the most part of the rest of the performance. And it was stressful at moments, but also kind of giggling and fun, and couldn't have happened anywhere else. And so it was really fun.
Oh, yeah. My God.
And that, a good story. And there were a bunch of videos that were sent to us by audience members afterwards of being like, look, we got a picture of the squirrel. So
oh, my God. I would
have
love to
video
see that
evidence.
Video. Yeah. I would love to see that. That is insane. Literally insane. Wow. What happened to the squirrel after that movement when everything stopped?
It made its way. So at either side of the stage, they have these big viney, like, and it just went back off into the woods.
Okay.
I don't know if it just thought that was beautiful music and wanted to be a part of it, or I don't know. Supposedly it's a normal experience. It's an outdoor venue. So I'm sure they were just like, oh, another person playing on the stage. Let's go enjoy.
I mean, I've performed outdoors and I don't think I've ever had an animal encounter.
I perform on my balcony. I've never had a squirrel join me, but there's a first time for everything.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's highly entertaining.
Yeah, it was super cool when it happened.
Yeah. All right. Can you tell me about Oliver?
Oliver is the best dog in the world. He is my best friend. He's a 7-year-old Labradoodle. He is all white with one brown patch of like eye and ear.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so he's very well known in the neighborhood because no other dog looks like him. And so he's kind of a celebrity in my neighborhood. And he likes to sing along when I play.
Oh.
So the pandemic was difficult because doing all those Zoom performances, I would have to like lock him in a bedroom far away and or have my partner like take him on a long walk and I'll be done in 2 hours.
Yeah. So. Oh my gosh. I never would have thought that that would be something to worry about in lockdown, but yeah.
Yeah, that was my life. I was asked a few times to do Zoom performances of things and it was just like the day of, I'd be like, oh, and Oliver, what do I do about my singing dog? But it is something that I always, whenever I move into a new apartment or when I moved in here with my partner, I always tell the neighbors because though they may really enjoy having a violinist live next to them, it may be something they didn't think was going to happen, that they would also have a howling dog.
Yeah.
So I always warn everyone and let them know I never practice after 7 p.m. and I never start before 8 a.m.
Right. That's,
no, I don't want him to sing. He just does.
Yeah, he can't stop, won't stop. Does it distract you when you practice if he's singing or you're able to focus?
Well, so what's interesting is that throughout the years, I've begun to realize like what causes him to sing. He seems far quieter when I play melodic single line things.
Okay.
But he really gets involved during double stops. So like if I'm playing Mozart, I can usually have him in the room and I can practice and get things done and it's fine. But if I'm playing Bach or if I'm working on Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, or the more double stops, the more involved the music is, the more involved he also wants to be. And so, yeah, there are moments, especially with new works and stuff like that, where I try for a little while to get things done. And then at a certain point, I'm like, okay, you gotta go.
Yeah.
Bedroom. Yeah. Like, okay. I gotta get some stuff done.
Oh, but that's still really cute that he's trying. He's trying to be there with you, supporting you through your practice.
Yeah, there's a special moment during the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto where he goes from being completely silent to the loudest version of himself. And it always happens at the same moment. So I have that on video as well because it's hilarious.
Really cute. Okay. Yeah. Oh, well, pet Oliver for me. Give him some love.
I will. Thank you.
Yeah. Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Sure.
Mahler or Bruckner?
Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Ooh, Ravel.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Appetizers or desserts?
Appetizers.
Sparkling or still water?
Sparkling.
Fan favorite question. Alternate universe musical instrument?
I've always wanted to play the snare drum.
What?
For a very specific reason. Speaking of Mahler. No, actually it was Shostakovich first and then it was Mahler. But like Shostakovich 10, second movement. If I could play the snare drum, I think my life would be complete.
Yeah. So here's my question. I know I'm going forward in some ways, but I know that you went to New World.
Mm-hmm.
And I know at New World for your birthday, you get to choose the instrument in the orchestra that you want to play for like a little ditty, right?
Oh, so this story has changed a little bit throughout the years. It used to be, and in my years at New World, it was that you got to do a cadenza, as we called it, a solo.
Yeah, yeah.
And they would like play Happy Birthday, and then when they get to da 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 da, They stop and you have to do something. And people got really interesting. Some people would play other instruments. Okay. One guy played Guitar Hero.
What?
Like, yeah. No, it was hilarious. He brought the Guitar Hero and like hooked it up to the video screen at the hall and played Guitar Hero for us.
How okay. Like just one song or?
Yeah, but like a full level, like from beginning to end. It took like 5 minutes. Yeah, it was intense. Okay. He was very good. Some people will play an actual cadenza, like make something up on their own instrument. Some people have danced. Yeah, so what did I do?
I was going to say, I mean, you could have just played snare drum.
That never occurred to me.
Okay.
Wow, that's interesting. That's really funny. No, I think I did a cadenza 1 year, some Mozart ditty thing, and then the other years, I did a skit 1 year. We get...
Oh, fun.
Yeah, things get really interesting at New World is an interesting place.
Yeah. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Oh. Sour Patch Kids?
Okay. They're pretty yummy. Yeah.
They're great. If there was one food that I wish was healthy for me, that's it.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Favorite professor shout out?
Paul Cantor.
Oh, Paul Cantor! If you're listening, we love you.
I love you dearly. You will always be my third father.
I think it's just incredible. I mean, he's just an incredible human, but also he's such a prolific teacher. And it always astounds me how he's able to do that. And
have you ever noticed that there are some teachers who are good at what they do, but it is not their calling?
Yeah.
You know? Like, if they'd rather perform or you see them do something else and you're like, oh, now I see you as an artist. But, like, his artistry is teaching.
Yes.
And like, we're just so lucky that he found it because he's so good at it. He's such a good teacher and he really would rather do nothing else than teach.
Yeah.
And that's our gift from him to the world. Like, it's so nice that he's there and wants to do that because he's amazing.
Yes. All the love is being sent to Paul Cantor right now. He's just such an amazing person. And those who have studied with him are very, very fortunate.
Yeah.
He's maybe one of my favorite professor shoutouts too.
I'm glad you agree.
Yeah. Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
I mean, as a Minnesotan, I have to say Prince.
Sure, yeah.
But artists that I've learned about recently that I'm super into and inspire me, Leanne LaHavas, beautiful singer from Britain.
Oh, okay.
She's amazing. And we wouldn't know about her if it weren't for Prince. He's the one who kind of brought her to the United States, so that's kind of
a
tie back. Mm-hmm. There's a connect. I am recently obsessed with Charlotte Cardin from Montreal. Her music really inspires me. And classically, Hilary Hahn constantly inspires me.
Sure.
Because I feel like every time I hear her play something again, it's different. And that is so hard to do, especially as a professional soloist. And it's inspiring to watch.
Yeah. I also feel like when she was making her name, she had this reputation of being completely perfect and clean all the time. And almost that it wasn't like things were changing. That it was, you're going to get Hilary Hahn playing the Brahms concerto. I feel like now that she's shedding that reputation, even if she wanted it or didn't want it.
It's as if she took notes.
Yeah.
It's as if she heard us out here in the world being like, oh, and I don't want to just be perfect at this. I want to be like inventive.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was from inside or if that's, but yeah, I can see her growth in every time I hear her play, which is really inspiring. It's not like the same version of her every single time now, which I just love.
Right.
So
yeah. Most transformative performance experience?
Ooh. I got asked to come down to Memphis and play for Juneteenth performance that my friend who started a music festival there was doing in honor of the festival. So it's a festival for kids. It's a music camp. And then he brings professionals down to do lessons. But on this particular occasion, he wanted to do a performance of the 7 Last Words of the Unknown. And on Juneteenth in the church that where they designed the sit-in, where the sit-in was designed that happened in Memphis just before MLK's assassination. And it was just to be with friends and Friends of Color and perform in, I mean, it's a dilapidated church. It's been kind of not taken care of. And to see Memphis in that way and to visit the museum there in honor of, or in history telling of not just MLK, but slavery in the United States and the civil rights movement, it was just the most inspiring weekend. And I've played that piece before, but I have never played it on a more perfect occasion. It was like I was getting hugged as I was playing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was telling a story that needed to be told. And yeah, I always feel like music allows me to have a voice in things that otherwise I would not know how to say.
Totally.
And that was one of those occasions on which I was definitely saying something that I had wanted to say for a really long time.
Oh my gosh, so, that's such a beautiful way of phrasing that. I'm getting all the chills right now, by the way. That's like so awesome. What a cool experience. And it's like, yeah, bringing together a community that needs, we all need healing from that. You know, it's our history and wow, how profound. Yeah. Can you explain a little bit of the premise of Seven Last Words of the Unknown? For those
A piece written, and I'm really bad with names and titles, so check me on this, or fill in the details, rather. But the movements are titled with the last words of seven men who were killed by police in the United States, and each title then is sung.
Actually, sorry to interrupt. It's actually Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. I think we've been
saying unarmed. Unarmed. Thank you.
Okay, I might have messed up. Yeah.
No. It was me who misspoke. So yeah, and give his name.
Joel Thompson.
Yes, thank you. And Joel is amazing. And each movement you get to hear kind of over and over again, those words sung, but also played throughout the orchestra. And it has both a choir of, it's supposed to be all male voices, and a solo male voice as well. And then full orchestra. It's a really meaningful piece. It's become more meaningful the more police shootings that we have, and feel like he could write some more movements, which is unfortunate. But it really speaks not just to those individual occurrences, but to the innocence of those men and the way in which their life was cut short, just to hear those last words that seem so incomplete. Super special.
Yeah, I'll just take a second to read every movement title. Mm-hmm. Why do you have your guns out? What are you following me for? Mom, I'm going to college. I don't have a gun. Stop shooting. You shot me. You shot me. It's not real. I can't breathe. And in that order, it's Kenneth Chamberlain, Trayvon Martin, Amadou Diallo, Michael Brown, Oscar Grant, John Crawford, and Eric Gardner. And yeah, now, I mean, I can't breathe probably doubles as well for George Floyd.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Yeah, so it's heavy, but at the same time, that piece, it's somehow uplifting to be able to give those, I don't know, maybe just giving them a chance to speak one more time.
Yeah.
It feels like we are remembering them through their own words rather than someone else's actions, right. Which feels more valuable in some way.
Yeah,
so.
Totally. I highly recommend checking this piece out for anyone who hasn't listened. I think it's on Spotify, and if it is, I will put it on our Spotify playlist for
you. Also on YouTube, you can see some of the live performances that have been done throughout the years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so meaningful. Wow. That's such a cool transfer. Yeah. I'm so happy you had that experience. Yeah. Desert island piece of any genre?
Oh, we have to pick one?
I know. I'm so cruel.
Gosh. Probably Wonderful by Leon Lajavas. That doesn't mean I always need words, but yeah. Yeah.
You finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Thank you. Wonderful.
Okay, thank you. All right, Amelia, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover music, the violin? When did you decide that that was your path and the steps along the way that landed you where you are today?
I grew up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. My mother was a single parent. She still basically is, although her children are grown. She was in a babysitting co-op as a young mom, where like the moms would get together and like take all the kids one day, and then the next mom would take, so that one mom or the rest of the moms could have a day off. And
I see.
You'd always have a babysitter.
Yeah.
That's
kind of a cool concept.
Yeah, it was really cool. She was kind of a hippie mom. But in that babysitting co-op or mom co-op that she was a part of, there was another mother who had a daughter who was in violin, and she was a little bit older than me. I think she was like 6. And my mom, just one day in talking to this other mom, the other mom said, oh, you know, you should really get your daughter into music, and violin is great for brain development and blah, blah, blah. And my mom, sure, being the said yes to almost anything, was like, okay. And so she just followed in the footsteps of this other mother and got me with the same teacher. And I was just lucky enough that it was a great violin teacher, Suzuki teacher in Minneapolis. And that teacher, Toyo Lang, who still teaches, I believe, did my first bit of training with me. And then at one point told my mother, hey, I think she's really talented and I can't teach her anymore. And I think these are the places that you should go. And that was really meaningful. First of all, I think more teachers should know when they need to pass someone on to the next level. And yeah, I'm so glad that she was able to do that. And she led me in a really good direction. I studied with Mary West, who's kind of a legend in Minneapolis, yes, who's now, yes, passed on, but she was, yeah, incredible. And then Mary, her husband died the end of my sophomore, beginning of my junior year of high school. And so she didn't feel like she could properly grieve and teach some of her older students. Yeah. And so she sent, there were like 7 of us that she sent over to Sally O'Reilly, and she asked Sally to help. And because we were about to, you know, take college auditions and, sure, all of those things. And yeah, she didn't want for us to get left behind. And thankfully, Sally was like, yes. So Sally O'Reilly was my teacher through the end of high school. And she said, you need to study with Paul Cantor.
Right.
And I, like a good little girl, I feel like everybody just kind of said, here's the road, travel down it.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay. And I took an audition and a lesson from Paul Cantor at University of Michigan. And he said yes. And there I was in the fall as a student of Paul Cantor. And that was a happy, beautiful decision that I'm not sure I made by myself. And
right. I'm sorry to, I just want to back up one bit. So, I mean, I know that the path was being made for you in some ways.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you must have had a personal connection to music in a way that you wanted to pursue it, right? You,
yeah,
wanted to go down that road. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess I left something big out, which is that when I was young, my mom had me in violin, but she also had me in a whole bunch of other stuff. Like I was, sure, in gymnastics and ballet and, right, orchestra and all the things.
Yeah.
And at some point at around the age of 10, my mom was like, I cannot be a school bus anymore. Mm-hmm. And you have a sister and I need to drag her around to places too. And you need to kind of like hone the field in and tell me what is most important to you. Okay. And so she sat me down and she said, you can't do ballet, which I was taking like 5 days out of the week, and,
yeah,
violin, which I was doing,
yeah,
4 or 5 days out of the week, lessons or orchestra or whatever. And I can't do both of those things. That's too much. So you need to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
And I went up to my room and sat down and thought about it. And I couldn't imagine my life without music. Like,
yeah,
I thought about future, and every future that I thought of or tried to invent in my head had a violin in it. And so I was like, I guess that's what I gotta do.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. That's exactly the same scenario my mom put me in as well. It's like I was much younger, so it was literally like you have to choose either ballet or music, and I had a similar.
I love that.
Yeah,
okay. I can't believe we're connected this way.
I know. Yeah, continue, yeah, your story though. Yeah.
No, so I actually wrote my college essay about that, which I had forgotten until I just told that story. Yeah. So when I went to Michigan, you know, you have to apply to the rest of the school too. So I,
right,
wrote my college essay about that.
Right.
But then let's see. I started with Paul. Paul told me that I should do my grad work with David Perry, and I said, sure, that sounds great. And so I went to University of Wisconsin with David Perry, and I started playing with Madison Symphony Orchestra, mm-hmm, while I was in grad school. And then I started auditioning for New World. It took me 3 auditions and I got, mm-hmm, into New World Symphony, and then I ended up there for 4 years. And then New World ended and I hadn't won an audition, though I had done well in auditions. I hadn't won anything.
But it was your objective to be an orchestral musician.
Yeah. I mean, once you go to New World, if you don't want to do orchestra, you're kind of in the wrong place, because that's,
yeah,
all I mean, you're doing some chamber music, but I think the goal of most of the people at New World, at least when I was there, and I think that's changing now, they have some more avenues, but the goal then was to create orchestral musicians who were ready for,
yeah,
the field. And so I was already subbing a little bit with Minnesota Orchestra, and my home was Minnesota. And so I thought, okay, I'll go live on my mom's couch for a little while and see if I can make life work. And I came home and 6 months later got my own apartment and was subbing pretty regularly with Minnesota and then took auditions from there, ended up in the Minnesota Opera, and here we are.
Yay!
Yay!
And then along the way, you also were a part of the Sphinx organization.
Yeah, so Aaron Dworkin, who started Sphinx, was at Michigan with me when I started.
Okay.
Yeah, so when he started Sphinx, he was in grad school at Michigan and I was an undergrad. And so I sent in a tape to like one of the very first years of the Sphinx competition saw it grow. And so when I became a professional and he grew the competition to the point where he wanted an all Black and Latinx orchestra to accompany the finalists, he called his friends first and foremost to create that first orchestra. And so I was involved in the orchestra from a very early period of time and have been involved ever since. And now it's wife's is the CEO and director. But yeah, we're close. I consider them good friends and I would do pretty much anything for Sphinx.
Wow, that's incredible. I actually hadn't known that background about how it all began.
Yeah.
I remember when it was a thing, but I didn't, it felt like it's been around forever.
This was to be the 25th anniversary this year and
2022?
We were supposed to have a special performance actually at the end of the month at the Kennedy Center. In honor of the 25th anniversary, but it's been postponed till next year because of COVID. So,
well, what can you do? Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to stay safe and healthy. That's all you can do, I guess, is what you can't. Yeah. So.
I have learned to roll with more punches than I have wanted to these past 2 years,
I'm
just
there
something.
With you.
Yeah. Just like, I guess I'm not in control. Sure. I hope it works out.
So do you have any current projects you're excited for?
So the next thing on the docket, because the Sphinx thing was canceled or postponed, is I'll go play with the opera at the end of the month and we'll do actually really cool project. They're doing their first African-American Black opera. It was written by Joseph Boulogne and Anonymous Lover. We're performing on February 5th, February 10th, 12th, 13th. There might be a couple other days that I'm forgetting, but yeah, that's the next project. And of course I'm excited about that because it's something that the opera has not done before.
Good for them.
It'll be really cool to be a part of that. And then hopefully the next thing on my schedule is to go back on tour with Sphinx in March.
Yeah. Okay, so virtuosi tour is going around.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So we did a fall tour and that was successful and we'll take that same group of repertoire plus a few pieces back on tour in the spring.
Got you. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, tell Meredith I say hi.
I will.
She's a close friend of mine. Yeah.
I love that lady.
Yeah, she's awesome. Also past guest of the podcast, but anyway.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Are you ready to take a break?
Sure.
Okay. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So you have had 12 years, am I correct to say, of experience being a yoga teacher. Mm-hmm. What's that like?
When I started, it was not a goal. I came back to Minneapolis and I had been taking yoga classes when I lived at New World in Miami and just thought I want to keep taking yoga classes. And there was a program here where you could like trade time at the studio cleaning for being able to get free access to yoga. And so I started doing that. And then a few of the teachers at the studio were like, you should go to teacher training. And I kind of was like, well, I'm not going to teach yoga. I'm a violinist. And then thought, well, I'd really like to learn more. So maybe I'll just do it for that reason. And so I went through teacher training. And then at the end, they wanted me to teach. They were like, you'd make a great teacher. Can you work for Core Power? And I said, sure. Because I was I was subbing with Minnesota Orchestra and who knows what my weeks were going to look like. Sometimes I was busy. Sometimes I wasn't. So it was a good kind of second job. I made a promise to myself really early on, like it will never take precedence over my career as a professional musician, but it will always support that. And if it can't, then I won't do it anymore.
Okay.
And what I learned, it was really funny. A couple years ago, a girlfriend of mine who's also subs with Minnesota quite a bit, Kate Bennett, came to me at Orchestra Hall. We were both subbing and she said, you know, you realize that when you get called to sub, it's because someone is out and they're not out sick usually. They're out because they're injured.
Right.
They're hurt because they've been playing too much and they want to give their shoulder, their arm, their whatever a break. And she was like, and you don't need a break.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, huh. And she was like, you've never had tendonitis. You've never had pain. And I said, yeah, that's true. And she said, why is that? And I said, well, probably the yoga. Like, I'm constantly aware of, like, stretching
and alignment
and using opposite muscles and applying activity to my bigger muscles so that I'm not overusing the small ones. And I'm just more aware and I'm more maybe balanced than I think a lot of us can be as musicians. You know, there's this thing in classical music, I think all across the genre, of just wearing our pain as a badge of courage.
Totally.
Like, you know, I did 8 hours of practice yesterday and my arm hurts so bad, but it's like, I did it. You know, I'm so good now.
Yeah.
Rather than when we feel pain, knowing that that's our body saying something's wrong and knowing what to do about it and being able to say, you know, this, I'm going to stop right now and do this other thing so that I make sure that I have a career that lasts really long, rather than end up in surgery at the age of 40 for a shoulder cuff that's destroyed. Yeah. So that's always been something that I'm aware of. I had a teacher, Shirley Santoro, was a violin teacher of mine just for a short while in Minneapolis. And she said, if you are in pain, stop. Stop playing and do something else until it doesn't hurt, and then you can come back and play again. And it was some of the best advice I've ever received. It means a lot to me to be able to step away and have something else that I'm good at, have something else that I find passion and value in. When the road is tough as a freelance artist, it is really, really nice to be able to go somewhere where my value is not inside how well I played the last run of Tchaikovsky. Where my value is as a teacher is just, I can teach a class that I think was just like kind of fine. And people give me hugs afterwards and are like, thank you so much. And oh, that was beautiful. And I feel so much better. And like, what better gift to give yourself than like that experience of just having someone value you for something that maybe you had forgotten? Because we spend so much time in the practice room being critical. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to move into a non-critical environment that has helped me in so many ways. You know, when I went through divorce and I was able to step into the studio and feel love from strangers as I went through something hard. You know, when the Minnesota Orchestra was locked out for 18 months and all of those people were suffering and not being able to do the thing that they loved and wondering if their orchestra was ever going to come back. And I got to go to a yoga studio every day and have people say thank you for being there and find value in myself. And it has been a balancing energy for me for the entire time that I've been doing it.
Yeah. Wow. It's just so fascinating. I mean, you're not the first guest to come on the podcast and speak about yoga and how important it is, or especially to us just physically for us as musicians. But I am always fascinated because everyone gains something very unique from yoga. Mm. Sure, there are some shared similarities across the board, but yeah, for you, it's like incredibly personal, and finding that fulfillment from the people that you are able to impart some of your knowledge onto.
Yeah. It's... And just feeling like there's something, I think a lot of us as musicians, our value or our self-worth or our accomplishments lie in like what we can do with our physical instrument. And it's nice to know that the knowledge that I have in music, I can apply in other ways. Like my students tell me all the time that my classes are their favorite because I'm a good teacher, but also because my music selection is so incredible. And that is only because I am an avid listener of music and I know composers and living artists, and I am a person who will spend, you know, hours going down the rabbit hole of iTunes on a Friday night when I find something that I like and like, oh, what's this? And like every time somebody says you might like this, I will go figure that out and find five other things like it. So my prowess, I guess, as a musician, I now experience in more ways than just my ability to play 16th notes or my ability to make a phrase long. It also shows up in ways that I hadn't even thought about, which is, I think, important for all of us as humans to kind of expand our perception of what is unique, special, important about ourselves.
I was also thinking as you're saying that, it goes back to a point you made a little bit earlier ago about us musicians. I feel like we always get so stuck in our head about things too. And I mean, yeah, we're moving our body and we're moving our arms, but it's for specifically the music. And so that's inside our head. So by doing yoga, it's like allowing you to actually be more expressive in some ways with your body when you're doing these poses or, you know, flowing between one to the next or something like that.
I like the ability to be able to examine. It was interesting to hear my first teacher and, you know, thousands of teachers since then tell me and tell the class that you could look at yourself and examine a posture or feel a posture in your body and not have judgment. Mm-hmm. That there isn't a good or a bad attached to it, but that mm-hmm. it's just experience it. Know what it is. Mm-hmm. Claim it. You know, give it names if you need to, but that there is no like good or bad value to it. It is not a judgment on your person. It's just an experience of the now.
Right. And we're so bad at that in music.
We're so bad at that. I mean, that's why we get stuck in auditions. We make one mistake and then we focus on that mistake and we're not in the moment of this creation of something beautiful. So it was important, and it is important for me every day to hear that and to say it out loud to other people, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it's so easy to get caught in that judgment, that moment of judgment, and to be called upon every day all the time to just, nope, that's not why you're doing it. Mm-hmm. This isn't about the perfect forehead to knee. This is about
right.
how you feel in that moment and how you affect feeling in that moment. Mm-hmm. And also, I've learned a ton about breath and mm-hmm. just my ability to calm myself, my ability to let go of what just happened, mm-hmm. which I don't think I would have learned. But just that constant reminder of like, that's over. That posture is finished. You can't go back mm-hmm. and it happened. And what's now? And the idea of like being able to practice my way. Practice takes on a different yeah. meaning in the yoga room. Yeah. You know, the idea that you can practice yeah. how to be still. And it is just the act of doing it over and over again and developing kind of like wagon ruts in the road towards your still place, then it makes me go to the instrument and develop different techniques of like, what am I creating wagon ruts for? What am I mm-hmm. making deep cuts in my thought process for? Mm-hmm. And are they things that are successful, or am I focusing on the mistake? Which has completely yeah. changed the way I practice.
Sure. And air quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, why do musicians have to think of practice as something that's like, why can't it be more like the yoga version of practice? Mm. And I mean, I think that's, yeah, that's the point you're trying to make.
Well, it's yeah. because we've been in school for 12 years and told like it has to be more perfect than it is.
Right.
And there is an element of that that is important, but I think changing the goal is meaningful. So instead of aiming for perfection, aiming for beauty or the way something feels or your ability to exist in the moment. I don't know. Yeah, changing yeah. the story you're telling yourself about it is valuable.
Yeah. I'm just going to do another huge Paul Cantor plug again. But I think that's why he's such an incredible teacher, is because he doesn't tell his students to be those things.
Yeah.
He asks the questions of the student to come to that decision on their own
yeah.
and be okay with how they do it. Oh my gosh, he's so awesome. But just,
well, yeah, there's that constant yeah. discussion with him. He is so good at, if a problem he sees in a student or a problem exists with something,
yeah.
if he can't get at it one way, if his first technique right. is unsuccessful, or he feels like you're not making the stride that he was hoping you to make or connecting the mm-hmm. neurons, he is mm-hmm. so quick to be able to like, well, let's try this door over here. mm-hmm. And there's right. no like, oh, this is really hard for you, or oh, this is really mm-hmm. not good enough. It's just like, let's try this. And if that's not it, then like, oh, there's this other window over there. Like, he has no shortage of like passageways to the goal mm-hmm. he has in mind for you. And that is so right. valuable as a student
right.
because then it gives you the idea that like, I just need to keep searching rather mm-hmm. than like,
but that's,
I'm going to put yeah. in 18,000 hours on this one thing and I just need to try a little harder. It's like, no, I need to try something different.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying is like, he's like this yoga master in
yes.
this way.
Yeah.
In music
yes.
is that he, it's like a gentle guide. And I assume that's what a yoga instructor is supposed to do in yoga. I know I'm kind of like intertwining all of this together.
No, it makes perfect sense. I think it's extremely valuable to realize that, yeah, you're supposed to be a gentle guide. You're not supposed to like create a road for someone else. They're supposed to create right. that road for themselves. You're just giving them tools. Right. You know, like, here's a chisel. How are you going to use it? Here's a brick. Where are you going to put it?
Yeah. Do you have any stories, though, to share about your experiences being a teacher? Like, maybe there's a particular...
Yeah, I've had a few that stand out to me. I had a student once... So, as an instructor, we are given the tools to adjust and put our hands on people during postures, but we are not required to use them. And so it becomes like a, I may walk over to you during class and say, and, you know, say like, would you like this to be deeper? Or, you know, I might say something. I might just point at a certain area of the body. I might use my physical body to move you in a certain way. All those things are possible or none of them. And I had in class one day, I had a student who was in a posture and I had the opportunity and saw a way in which I could apply. And I always think of it as like love. Like I'm giving you the ability to go further mm-hmm. and to experience a posture in a different way if I use my physical hands or some part mm-hmm. of my body. And I went to do that for her and she kind of shrugged me off. And mm-hmm. in that moment, most of us assume like, oh, there's some pain or there's some injury that we're unaware of that they don't want to move deeper into that particular posture. And that's why they've done that. That's my first.
Yeah.
So after class, I caught up with her and I said, hey, you know, if there's an injury, please let me know. And I'm so sorry if I affected your practice in a negative way. And she said, oh, I don't need your help in yoga. I'm a very experienced yogi. You need to correct people who need correction, and I don't need correction. And it was so interesting to hear that because she was so stuck in a mindset of like me addressing her in practice meant that I was correcting her and that was the only way she received practice. Like there was nothing about a teacher that was positive. Mm-hmm. There was just this like judgment. And I hadn't done that. I was standing there in front of her telling her, no, that's not what that was. But she was unable to receive it any other way. She said, no, she kept saying, no, no, I don't need that. And yeah,
it's like a weird pride thing.
Yeah. And what it did for me is just reminded me how many people perceive things differently. And so since mm-hmm. then, I always introduce, or as many times as I can remember to do it, I introduce adjustments and the idea of me, you know, if using blocks or using straps or other assistance in the yoga room as mm-hmm. like, this isn't, I'm not trying to make your body look like someone else's body. I'm not trying to like correct right. you into the perfect version of this posture. I, mm-hmm. as a teacher, and any tool that you use should only allow you to experience more of the posture that you're in. Mm-hmm. And so if you use a block, it allows you to sit with something that otherwise you probably couldn't sit with. Mm-hmm. If you use a strap, it allows your arms to reach for something that they couldn't reach for with. Like it brings the yeah. posture to you. I'm not changing you. I'm not correcting something. That is not what yoga is here for. And that was mm-hmm. so important for me to be able to verbalize because I think the idea of a teacher, especially in the Western culture, is someone who is correcting behavior. And so,
right.
yeah, to be able to take that out of it and be like, no, I'm just giving you some extra love. Like, mm-hmm. I think yeah. that you could be able to feel something different if only I put my hand right there. Right? and then like, wow, things could happen. And wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah. Like, don't we all want that hand? And it's like an invitation. And that's how I see
yeah.
it was an important lesson for me to learn, but I wish that I continue to try and teach it to as many other people as possible because I think it's so important
yeah.
for
yeah.
growth.
She never came around?
She stopped taking my class.
Oh, okay, well, there.
Yeah.
I guess that's one way to do it. Yeah.
But that's the thing. Like, you can't, if you're not ready, if you're not willing to hear that, then there's nothing another
yeah.
person
right.
can offer you.
Right. Exactly.
So yeah. I just, that's another thing that yoga has taught me. It's a lot of just like acceptance. There
yes.
you are. And here I am, and we're not in the same place, and that's okay. Because, like,
right,
you know,
right.
it's the ability to just be like, well, I can't change that, so that's too bad.
Well, yeah, just like now.
Let me focus on this other thing that I might be able to change.
Right. How has the pandemic changed your teaching?
I was not one of those teachers who started teaching virtually.
Okay.
I had friends who did it. I thought about it. I took some virtual classes. I didn't feel good in them or as good mm-hmm. as I want, like the way I remembered feeling in a live yoga mm-hmm. class. And so I quickly decided like that is a group of skills that I would struggle with and have to get mm-hmm. used to and fail at and succeed at and work my way through. And that's not a a way in which I want to use my energy right now, because that's not something I want to cultivate. And so I stopped teaching for the period of time in which Core Power was closed and yoga studios were closed. And then as soon as they said, we're opening the door, I was like, please get me back in there, because it was very evident to me that I needed it, didn't want to live without it, definitely wanted to have it in my future. So I took the time off and then I went back.
So now you're active. Are you still, you're teaching?
I'm teaching. I teach five classes a week at Core Power, both in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And
do you have room in your studios?
Up until the recent government or governor changes here in Minnesota, I was teaching unmasked, but now we're back to masking and all of that. A little bit of PTSD there, as we, you know, like, oh my gosh, I know. I can't go back.
I know. It's like March is coming around again. It's like 2 years later.
No.
Yeah. This was supposed to only stop a month. Right. Like, we were all like, oh, this is only going to be a month. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm okay, teaching again. I love it. And won't stop.
Yeah. Great. Probably. Are there any lasting thoughts that you wanted to share with us about your journey through yoga and any of the following?
I just think that there are a lot of misconceptions, a lot of things that we tell ourselves about yoga, about like, oh, it's a bunch of stretching, or it's about meditation. And people come to, especially, I love the thing about Core Power is that it's taught from a very kind of Western, like, come to it, maybe you'll get stronger, you'll probably get, you know, some physical skills. And then along the way, like, because we've just opened the door to like, you just want to be healthy, and this is a good way to be healthy, you can make your way in. And eventually along that route, the majority of my students realize that they are indeed meditating. They are indeed learning how to breathe. And there is some quote unquote dogma that they are able to receive regardless of what religion or lack thereof they came from. It kind of just finds a way in to your being. You don't need to give it a name or like ascribe to learning Sanskrit or whatever. Like, it just finds a way in. And so I just wish that more people would give it a try, because they like being able to stand on their head and don't worry about the rest, you know, or like give it a try because their best friend does it. Or I don't know, get there, because I have yet to meet a person who's like, that sucked.
Yeah. Right.
So
totally.
Yeah.
Give it a shot. Well, can I ask you two final questions?
Sure.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
Don't put yourself in a box. Don't tell yourself there's just one way to do it. And I wish that I had listened to the energies around me that were pushing me in the direction of chamber music and opera and ballet. I had some very unique experiences early on in my career that I was like, ooh, this is really cool. And then I kept taking orchestra auditions, not kind of realizing that I could turn in that particular direction and kind of make my life as full as I wanted it to be. Because I should definitely be an opera and ballet musician. Like, I love being in the pit. I love playing chamber music. There's no way that, although I love playing orchestra, there is something truly special and unique, and that I am maybe more honed towards, that I could have realized sooner. So I wish I, when the first time I played an opera, I was like, oh yeah, that's what I want to do. But maybe I needed to do all those other things before.
All right. And as we enter a post-pandemic world-ish, I don't know where we are in that anymore. I wrote this question a while ago.
Post-pandemic, that sounds lovely.
What elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue? What would you want to shed?
I've enjoyed doing some pre-concert, post-concert talks that we've done virtually rather than, you know, like doing them in person. So, well, people have watched our thing online or have watched something the night before, and then we meet with them virtually from our living rooms when they have time. I think there's real value in that, being able to, there's something about the stage itself that makes you feel really far away from someone, that like when you're just on Zoom and you're just sitting, then I've had students, I've had young adults and school age children ask better, more intriguing questions and be more involved in conversation over Zoom than we do when we're like at a concert hall and we're like, do you guys have any questions from the stage? So I really appreciate that new avenue. I think we could find a way to take that forward and make that really interesting, maybe from backstage, or I don't know, but like, yeah, I think there's room for some real growth there in the way we communicate with audiences and show what it is that we do. And I've had some really interesting connections with people that I maybe would not have otherwise. So I hope that I continue to connect in new ways and finally the balcony series that I started for myself. I may not do it every day like I did that sure. first season, but I see a real value in creating my own stage rather than waiting mm-hmm. for the call.
Yes, that's how I feel too. Did you say what you would shed? I can't remember.
What I would shed? No, I didn't. I am a freelancer, and so I'm used to saying yes to everything that comes down the pike. You want me to, mm-hmm. are you going to pay me? Okay, great, I'll do it. And I think yeah. now maybe I have the knowledge and can see a bigger picture, and I might be able to say, like, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And that's what, maybe that's not something I would shed is a bad word, but like, I would shed that mm-hmm. constant, like, just take the work, take like whatever yeah. it is, but actually yeah. be me and then choose mm-hmm. the work.
Yeah, I definitely think, all of us, and I think it's not just in music, although that is such a universal emotion as a freelancer. Yeah. It's like, give me all, like, just, I'm hungry, give
I'll
me all the
yes,
work.
Yes.
Yeah. yeah. But I feel like a lot of us are adjusting to better listen to what our work-life balance should be, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's like, I think that's so huge. So I'm really glad that that's happening for you as well. Okay. Are there any platforms or websites for listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
I have a website for the series that I started on my balcony, and it's dormant mostly during the wintertime as far as balcony concerts are concerned. I always post
sure.
things on there about if there's a virtual opportunity for them to see me play from their living rooms. So that is tinybalconyconcerts.org. And that also has a link up if you are a fellow artist and you want to collaborate, you can send me a note there. Or if you have an event that you think would be best served by me playing violin in some capacity, there's a way there to connect and set something up. It all goes to my email, so I get all those messages. I respond pretty quickly. It has some recordings of the things that I did on the balcony, some things that I've done over the past 2 years, so it's a good way to see like who I am as an artist. It connects to my Facebook page, so you can say okay. hi that way.
Yeah,
and
it really
please
is
check out Sphinx.
Key to everything.
Sphinx will be here in St. Paul in April, and we'd love to see you in the audience. I will certainly say hi from the stage and give a shout out to the Minnesota crowd. We're also doing
it's at the Ordway, right?
This year it's at Schubert Club.
Oh, Schubert Club.
Yeah, so
okay.
right across the street, but yeah, right there.
Yes.
We're doing that performance, and then actually we're doing a collaboration with the Minnesota Orchestra in May as well. So at the end of
awesome.
May, you'll be able to see Sphinx on stage with the Minnesota Orchestra then as well.
Amazing.
So, yeah, cool things
yeah.
nearby.
Awesome. All right. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. Doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of the crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydnMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at Haydn Music Stand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, haydnmusicstand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries, there's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Thank you so much, Amelia, for joining me today. It makes my heart warm to know that we have so many shared past experiences.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. And thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Yay. Say bye, Sushi.